Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to start with a very familiar cliche. That is the proposition that you've heard often, that inflation is an international phenomenon. That's a statement which has, if you stop and think about it, various interpretations. It may simply mean that inflation is something that we can observe, admittedly at varying rates, and almost, I should say, in all countries around the world. That's a simple fact of life today. Alternately, it may be a proposition which has some analytical content. It might be argued, for example, that our current inflation is something which is caused somewhere out there in the world, and that it's imported into Canada. Now, that particular interpretation has been twisted around on occasion and given strong political content. Our Prime Minister, before he became a convert to price and wage controls, you may recall, used to argue that inflation was really an imported phenomenon, an international phenomenon over which we had no control. We could do nothing about it. Thirdly, or fourthly, I suppose, it might mean that the experiences of other nations with respect to inflation and attempts to control inflation are relevant in analyzing our own inflationary problems and in designing policy to cope with inflation. And it follows from that, I think, that it makes some sense for us in Canada to listen very carefully to distinguished students of the inflation problem who have studied it most intensively in other national contexts. It's in that spirit this evening, then, that I would like to present to you Professor David Laidler of the University of Western Ontario. Professor Laidler, by origins, as an Englishman. He is, however, a truly international student of that international problem, inflation. Educated both in Britain and in the United States, where he attended the University of Chicago, renowned throughout the world for its work in monetary economics and for the development and propagation of what we now call the monetarist view of inflation. He has been on the faculty of distinguished universities both in the United States and Britain, and is currently on the faculty of the University of Western Ontario, one of Canada's best economics departments. Maybe I'll say that now with Professor Laidler there, they're a strong second best. When he left the University of Essex in, 1970-71, he organized, along with his colleague, Professor Michael Parkin, the Manchester Workshop on Inflation at the University of Manchester. This thoroughly academic-sounding institution quickly attained international renown as the center for the systematic analysis of inflation, its causes, consequences, and cures. Among the publications, among the many publications emanating from that workshop, I'd like to cite only two because of their particular relevance for the topic tonight. One was a volume by Parkin and Sumner and called, quite simply, Incomes Policy and Inflation. The other, a volume edited by Laidler and Purdy called Inflation and Labor Markets, two rather influential books. As a measure of the stature of Professor Laidler in this field, I would also note that he, along with his colleague Michael Parkin, was invited recently by the Royal Economic Society to prepare sort of the definitive survey article on inflation, which has just been published in the English journal, the Economic Journal. This is a paper which I am quite convinced will be a classic in the field, demonstrating enormous depth and breadth in the understanding of the literature, decisive analytical skill, a clear perception of policy issues and dilemmas, and a characteristic concern for the empirical realities of the problem. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chairman, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Professor Laidler. I am quite certain that many of you will be surprised by the conclusions which he draws. Many of you may, in fact, disagree with his conclusions. I'm equally certain, however, that you will be challenged by his discussion of the question of incomes policy, the experience elsewhere, and the implications of this experience for Canada.
First, thank you, Ron, for that very nice introduction. You didn't take back the one piece of misinformation in the program. I am not yet a Canadian economist. I am, in fact, a very recent immigrant to Canada. I arrived in July, and for 3.5 months, I lived in blissful happiness. And then on Thanksgiving evening, I switched on the television and got a sinking feeling in my stomach, which I thought I had left behind me in England. What I really want to do this evening is explain to you why I got that sinking feeling in my stomach, and then go on to talk about what, had it been said, would have left me feeling better. In short, I shall argue first that if we extrapolate from the British experience, there is no earthly reason to believe that controls on wages and prices in this country will be anything other than what they were in Britain, that is to say, a total disaster, both economically and socially. And I shall then proceed to argue that there quite simply, in the present state of knowledge, is no substitute for the orthodox cures for inflation that have been known for a long, long time, monetary and fiscal policy. Now, I don't think that it is an accident that Britain is in the lead in two sets of statistics. It's had more experience since the Second World War with wage and price controls than any other Western country. I've made a little note of the periods for which they've been in force here, 1948 to 50, 1956 to 7, 1961 to 64, 1965 to 69, and 1972 to date. That's a pretty good record. We've had a lot of experience with wage and price controls in Britain. And we've also got the highest inflation rate in the Western world. And I don't think that's an accident either. Now, the effectiveness of wage and price controls has been very carefully and extensively investigated in Britain by academic economists, and not just academic economists who are constitutionally opposed to wage and price controls, but those who are quite favorably disposed towards them as well. And there is some room for debate as a result of their work. It is possible to take the view, as a result of that work, that those wage and price controls had no effect whatsoever, and it's possible to take the view that on balance they made the inflation worse. I beg your pardon. I know of no study which shows that on balance wage and price controls have had any marked effect in significantly reducing the rate of change of prices. Now, I think it's important to try and give you some flavor for the way in which these studies have been carried out, because obviously it would be hopelessly naive simply to inspect the time path of the inflation rate and then look at the periods over which price controls were enforced and those over which price controls were not enforced and to say, aha, the inflation rate was higher or lower when the controls were on or whatever might be the case. Whenever you're trying to work out what the effects of wage and price controls were on the inflation rate, you must be doing something rather difficult, that is comparing what actually happened with what would have happened if only the controls hadn't been in force. Now, the way economists set about dealing with this kind of problem is to construct economic models on the basis of data generated in periods when the controls were not in force. And then to extrapolate from those models to what would have happened according to those models over the periods when controls were in force had the controls not been operative, and compare the predictions of the model with what actually happened. Now, obviously, there's a great deal of witchcraft involved in that kind of exercise. But what's impressive, you see, about the British evidence is that Model A tells you on balance controls didn't work. Model B tells you on balance controls didn't work. Model C tells you on balance controls didn't work. That's a result that comes from a wide variety of models, from a wide variety of sources, and my judgment is that it's a result that's sufficiently strongly developed that we can actually believe it's telling us something about the world as it was in Britain in the period 1948 down to the present. Now, let me just say immediately that there is one exception to this general proposition, and that's the first episode of wage and price controls in 1948-49. There is every reason to believe that they did succeed in bringing down the rate of wage and price inflation for a period of about 18 months. But it's also the case that that was a time in which Britain was still very much a war economy, and the government had at its disposal the whole array of wartime controls to go alongside their wage and price controls. In periods when the government didn't have those kind of wartime powers available, no effect, except for quick freezes. It certainly is the case, and there's evidence from the United States to this effect as well, that if a government announces a 3-month or a 6-month freeze for about 3 months or 6 months, the rate of inflation slows down. And when the freeze comes off, the rate of inflation speeds up again, and actually for about another 3 to 6 months is faster than it otherwise would have been, so that at the end of the 6-month or the 12-month period, prices have gone up just as much on average as they would have done in the absence of controls, with only a difference in timing. Now, this doesn't mean that wage and price controls have not had effects on the British economy. They've had lots of effects on the British economy. The one effect they haven't had has been significantly to reduce the rate of inflation. Let me just talk a little bit about what those effects have been. First, they have created shortages of particular goods. By freezing the prices of particular goods at particular times, they have generated excess demands for those particular goods. Goods have vanished from the supermarket shelves because it's no longer been possible to produce them. To take a trivial but I think quite graphic example, in 1972, London Transport got its fares up. Then the government introduced wage and price controls before London taxi fares could be adjusted upwards. The consequence of this was that two or three people taking a taxi could make their bus journey more cheaply in the taxi than they could in the bus. The result of this was that the taxis went plying up and down the bus routes, and nobody could get a taxi until that particular anomaly was removed. And one could multiply this kind of example time and time again, the sheer irritation of having goods disappear, reappear, having their quality lowered, has to be experienced to be fully understood, and I'm rather afraid that in this country we're going to start in the next year or so experiencing that kind of thing. The next thing that wage and price controls inevitably do is promote cheating. It's all very well saying that in a society which is made up of publicly spirited citizens, that everyone would obey the law. But unfortunately, it is not the case that societies are made up of that kind of individual. There are some people who are more public-spirited than others. Now, why would people want to break this kind of law? Well, I think you've got to stop for a moment and just think about what an uncontrolled market price transaction involves. It involves a voluntary agreement between a buyer and a seller that the price which the buyer is paying is still leaving him with some gain from the transaction, and the price that the seller is receiving is leaving him with some gain from the transaction. Now look, that's not to say that the buyer wouldn't be happier if he could get the same thing at a lower price, or that the seller wouldn't be happier if he could get a higher price for what he has to sell. But it is a voluntary transaction. When you control a market price, you are telling them either to trade at a lower price than one that is mutually agreeable, or not trade at all. You therefore give both the buyer and the seller an incentive to collude, to evade the regulations. And when the buyer and seller both have an incentive to collude and evade the regulations get very, very difficult to enforce. Now, again, one can go on and multiply examples of this kind of behavior from Britain. Let me just mention one. And I'm afraid it's anecdotal evidence, because, of course, the one thing you can't get hard evidence on is evidence of law-breaking. But it appears to be the case that the British Steel Corporation, a nationalized industry, not even a profit-making capitalist organization, but a nationalized industry, was subject to price controls and was invoicing its British customers through continental agents as if the steel that it was selling to them was imported and therefore not subject to price controls. Now, that's pretty difficult to document, but that is a widespread anecdote, which I have every reason to believe is true. There are similar anecdotes to be told about the behavior of other major companies in the private sector. I believe it is also the case that when the United States tried a similar experiment in price controls, that a lot of American cattle emigrated to Canada to be slaughtered, to be re-imported to the United States for similar reasons. Well, it seems to me to be a very bad kind of law that makes it profitable for the least honest members of society. And I think there's a good reason to argue that if you want to sum up the effects of British price controls in a nutshell, it first of all made those who were not very straight in the first place rich, and as a matter of self-preservation, made more honest citizens a little less straight than they had been in their dealings. And I think that's a sad and serious thing when the law promotes that kind of behavior. Now, where it's difficult to cheat, the controls have different effects. And I don't think that anybody should be under any illusion but that it is easier to control wages than it is to control prices. There are just too many ways of shading the quality of products, of shading the level of services that go along with the products, to really nail down prices. Wages are easier to police and easier to control. And again, recall that I said that British controls had no effect on the rate of price inflation. But there is quite a bit of evidence that they had a little bit more success on the rate of wage inflation, which is another way of saying that they had some effect on real wages. They lowered the real standards of living of members of the labor force. Now, you may regard that as desirable or undesirable. This is not the point. The point is that where it's difficult to cheat the regulations, those who are being affected by the regulations come to resent them and come to resent the authorities that are imposing those regulations upon them. That is to say, wage and price controls in the United Kingdom were certainly socially divisive. Now, one of the reasons why we think inflation is a really serious problem is that in redistributing income and wealth in the arbitrary way it does, it's socially divisive. Wage and price controls exacerbate that divisiveness, if the British experience can be extrapolated from. They actually aggravate the symptoms of the disease rather than mollifying them. Now, I think this effect is particularly important in the current Canadian context, and because I've heard it argued time and time again in the last few months, as indeed I heard it argued in Britain from the business community, that though on the whole wage and price controls aren't very nice and we'd sooner do without them, at least it enables us to get to grips with these monopolistic trade unions that are eating into our profitability. Now, it may be true, indeed it certainly is true, that certain trade unions are monopolistic and are a nuisance, just as it is true that certain large corporations are monopolistic and are a nuisance. But it is an incredibly short-sighted view to take to think that if you are facing a monopolistic trade union movement which is willing to take on a major industry with a strike to get its own way, that somehow if a government sets up a prices and incomes commission or an anti-inflation board, that the union is simply going to lie down and take that. What happened in Britain with the miners' strike was quite simply that an employer, which happened to be a nationalized industry, found itself like the walnut in the nutcracker between a very angry and resentful trade union on the one hand and a very angry and stubborn government on the other, and suddenly had no control whatsoever over its own labor relations. And that, again, is not an accident. That is what happens when you start politicizing the wage bargaining process in the presence of strong trade unions. Moreover, I think there's every reason to believe from the British experience that the presence of wage and price controls, far from weakening monopolistic trade unions or monopolistic trade associations, strengthens them. And why is that? It's very simple. Once you have wage and price controls in force, the kind of share of the national income that you can extract becomes not an economic matter, not a matter of the value of what you can produce to your customers, not a matter of your ability to exercise some monopolistic market power. It becomes a political matter. It becomes a matter of how much political muscle can you bring to bear on the government, on the anti-inflation board, on the bureaucracy, in order to raise your share. And that doesn't weaken a trade union, that strengthens it. That ensures that its members have got nowhere to look but the union in order to exercise that political muscle for them. Now, I don't want to get myself deeply involved in arguments tonight about the extent to which trade unions are a good thing or a bad thing. But what I do want to stress is that if you think that wage and price controls, no matter how bad they might be in other ways, nevertheless will come to grips in this country with a problem of monopoly in the trade union sector or monopoly in the corporate sector, I think that that view is just totally short-sighted and easily refutable in terms of British experience. Now, let me try and sum up this part of what I have to say. I've argued that wage and price controls haven't worked. I've argued that though they haven't worked to cure inflation, they've caused a lot of other troubles, social and economic. And why is that? Seems to me that the fundamental reason for that is that they are trying to get to grips not with the causes of inflation, but with the symptoms of inflation. That the analysis which leads to the proposition that wage and price controls will reduce the inflation rate confuses the symptoms of inflation with its root causes. It is not the case. There is no evidence that it is the case, as far as the United Kingdom is concerned at least, that trade unions or private monopolies have ever exercised any systematic influence over the inflation rate. They are not at the root cause of it. Now, please, I am not saying that trade unions and monopolies don't influence the course of inflation. The kind of trade union structure that an economy has, the kind of corporate structure that an economy has, affects the way in which inflation manifests itself and works through the economy, the pace at which it works through the economy. It certainly affects the way in which the symptoms of the disease show themselves. But there is no reason from the evidence of the British experience, or indeed from economic theory, to believe that the presence of that kind of monopoly causes or has caused an ongoing inflation. So, the question arises, you know, what do I think does cause an ongoing inflation? And Ron Shearer effectively gave the game away by mentioning the word monetarist. Monetarist used to be a term of abuse in Britain, but we got used to sort of wearing it as a handy label, so I'll cheerfully acknowledge it. What does a person who wears that label believe causes inflation? Effectively, monetary policy. Monetary policy in this country emanating from the Bank of Canada and the Canadian Treasury. Monetary policy in Britain emanating from the Treasury and the Bank of England. It's trite to say it, but let me repeat it. There has never been a sustained inflation that has been recorded which was not accompanied by a rate of increase in the quantity of money in circulation, which in terms of the Canadian economy means currency plus deposits with chartered banks, that will do. Nor has there ever been a sustained increase in the quantity of money in the economy at a rate substantially in excess of the rate of growth of real income that was not accompanied by an inflation. In short, monetary expansion appears to be a necessary and a sufficient condition. I beg your pardon, I should say monetary expansion substantially in excess of the rate of growth of real output is both a necessary and a sufficient condition for a sustained price inflation. Now, what I want to do now is start to go into the details of that proposition, what it really implies in terms of economic policy, what it really implies in terms of what is a feasible goal for any economy to set itself. Oh. Excuse me. First, I would not wish to claim for a moment that any kind of economic policy known to mankind can produce a state of perfect price stability on a month by month or quarter by quarter or even year by year basis. We seem to be having a lot of trouble down the frontier, don't we? It's okay. Where was I? Yes. Yeah. The most that you can really expect is to aim for a zero rate of change on average over a number of years of the general price index. You can't have price stability for everybody all the time. If the price of oil goes up, people who drive a lot have their cost of living go up. If the price of food goes up, the people who spend a large proportion of their income on food, and that means poor people, have their cost of living go up. And there is no magic in monetary policy or fiscal policy that can cope with that kind of problem. So the first thing to realize is that the kind of goal of price stability that you can get to is rather a modest one. The second thing I think that you have to realize is that even if you had the kind of monetary policy that I would like to see, the kind of monetary policy that it would involve the rate of growth of the money supply being roughly equal to the rate of growth of real national income, that wouldn't mean that all kinds of fluctuations in real income and unemployment would vanish. No one is suggesting for a moment that monetary policy can guarantee you full employment all the time or anything like that. It can't. Moreover, if you gear your monetary policy towards the pursuit of price stability, you have given up the opportunity to use monetary policy in order to achieve an employment goal. You can't have it both ways. You can't shoot at two targets with the same weapon. But this really shouldn't worry you too much, because subject to some fairly important qualifications, which I will come to in a moment, there is every reason to believe that variations in levels of government expenditure and taxation can usefully be used towards ironing out remaining fluctuations in the level of real income and employment. And there's nothing that I know of in the kind of monetary theory that I think has empirical support from just about every economy that's been looked at to suggest that fiscal policy can't be used as a short-run stabilization device of that kind. Moreover, there's no reason to suppose that if you actually go ahead and pursue this stable monetary policy, that the level of unemployment in the economy around which you're going to get fluctuations is going to be regarded as desirable. There's no reason to suppose that the level of unemployment in the Canadian economy, if inflation vanished tomorrow, would settle down at some socially acceptable level. But again, there is no particular reason to get too perturbed about that. It's no implication of what I'm arguing here that you should ignore that kind of problem. We know a great deal about the factors which influence the level of the average level of unemployment in an economy. We know that certain regions of economies are depressed, and we know that it is possible to reduce the unemployment that arises from that, either by making it possible for the surplus labor in those regions to go to high employment areas, or indeed to gear industry to go to the surplus labor regions. And there's nothing in what I'm saying that should rule that out. We can debate that kind of policy on its merits at a separate time. Moreover, we know that the educational level of the population has something to do with the level of unemployment that you actually experience. And we know that you can take policies towards education to improve the unemployment situation in that respect. We know that lack of labor mobility, either between regions or between professions, between skills, is a source of unemployment. And we know that by breaking down the obstacles to labor mobility, either produced by bad housing policy, such as rent controls, or by the restrictive practices of trade unions or the restrictive practices of professional associations that make it difficult for people to re-equip themselves with new skills and move into new jobs, we know that those things cause unemployment. There is a whole battery of active policies that you could reasonably expect a government to take to deal with that kind of unemployment problem. To say that you are therefore going to gear your monetary policy towards the control of the price level is not to say that you forget about all the other economic problems that any government might reasonably be expected to deal with. It's just to say that you can't use monetary policy, and indeed that it's inappropriate to use monetary policy to deal with all those other problems. Now, I said that there were some important qualifications here, and I think we have to really begin to get to grips with them. Because when we say control the rate of growth of the money supply, keep it growing along at the rate of growth of real income, that sounds like some kind of technical problem for the Bank of Canada to cope with, something that doesn't perhaps have too much political significance. But in fact, it has a great deal of political significance, and for the following reasons. The kind of policies that I've just been talking about, and policies towards the redistribution of income, policies towards the provision of national defense, and all the rest of it, are going to be there, and they need to be financed. The government, just both provincial and federal, just like anybody else, have to balance their books. Now, let me focus on the federal government's problems and what it can do to balance its books. Essentially, it has three ways of financing its expenditure. It can finance its expenditure out of taxes, or it can finance its expenditure out of borrowing from the general public, issuing government bonds to the general public. But the government has got a third way of financing its expenditure. It can borrow from the Bank of Canada. And it borrows from the Bank of Canada either directly by issuing bonds to the Bank of Canada and having the Bank of Canada write a deposit in the name of the government, or by rather more subtle indirect means, by borrowing from the chartered banks and having the Bank of Canada make available to the chartered banks the funds to buy the government securities. Now, this sounds like a rather technical and obscure kind of operation. And indeed it is. But it's just the same in its effect as printing money. It is just the same in its effect as the effect of a medieval monarch calling in his coinage, melting it down, and reissuing it with a little bit more lead mixed in with the gold. It's exactly the same operation. That is to say that once you have said control the rate of monetary expansion as the linchpin of your monetary policy and your anti-inflation policy, you have also said, therefore, the ability of the government to finance its expenditure is limited. There is only a certain amount of that expenditure that can be financed by borrowing from the Bank of Canada. The rest must be financed by taxes or by government sales of government securities. Now, taxes are unpopular. Taxes are terribly unpopular. What do? Taxes cut down private spending and make room for the government expenditure. And nobody likes to have their private spending cut down. Bond sales in large amounts are unpopular because bond sales in large amounts drive up interest rates. And in driving up interest rates, they make it more difficult for the private sector to borrow to finance its expenditure. And again, you release resources to the government. So it's not surprising that government is much more willing to indulge in expenditure than it is to finance that expenditure by taxes and bond sales, and therefore resorts to borrowing from the Bank of Canada. But of course, the inflation impoverishes the private sector and the government gets its resources that way instead. There's no difference. Inflation is a tax just like any other tax, but it's a tax that can be levied without legislation. Now, what's this to say? This is not to say that the level of government expenditure shouldn't be high if people desire it to be high. It is to say that if it's going to be high, taxes have got to be high, or bond sales have got to be high, and interest rates have got to be high, if you are to avoid inflation. Inflation, that is to say, is stemming fundamentally from an attempt to keep government expenditure high and taxes and bond sales low. And inflation is the result of that inconsistent policy. Now, there's another limitation upon what the government can do that stems from this analysis. And that concerns the exchange rate. Suppose that Canada was, by some miracle, a zero inflation economy. And suppose that the United States wasn't. What would you expect to happen then? You would expect Canadian exports to be getting relatively cheaper in the United States exports to Canada to be getting relatively more expensive. You would expect Canada then to start generating a balance of payments surplus. And you would all shout, whoopee, what a lovely thing. How long is it since we've had a balance of payments surplus? But what does that balance of payments surplus mean? It means simply that Canadians are taking in more US dollars than Americans are taking in Canadian dollars. And the net difference is going to be taken along to the bank or to the Bank of Canada to be cashed in for Canadian dollars. And in buying in the US dollars in exchange for Canadian dollars, the Bank of Canada is going to be expanding the money supply, simply as a result of that. That is the mechanism whereby inflation gets imported under a system of fixed exchange rates, which is to say that if you are really serious about having domestic control over your domestic inflation rate, you can't have a fixed exchange rate. You must be prepared to let the exchange rate rise upwards in order to keep that balance of payments surplus out. Now, what can we say about this? Well, there's another point to be made. Policy towards the exchange rate is going to interact with fiscal policy and policy towards the financing of government expenditure. If the government decides to operate at a high level of activity and to finance that activity by bond sales, thereby keeping domestic interest rates high, those high domestic interest rates are going to generate a capital inflow into Canada and keep the exchange rate up, or indeed keep it rising. You can see signs of that happening right now. The consequence of that, of course, is that Canadian exporters find themselves being badly squeezed, and the producers of import substitute goods find themselves being badly squeezed. Of course they are. What's happening? The government's taking resources. It's got to get them from somewhere. It's squeezing them out of the export industries. That's what it's doing. And again, if you're serious, however, about coping with inflation and simultaneously wish to run a high level of government expenditure and simultaneously wish to run rather low taxes, then the consequences which I've just described are what you're going to get. High interest rates, capital inflows, balance of trade deficits, problems in the export industry with employment in the export industries and in the import competing industries. There is no way out of that particular box. Now, what I've said, I think so far, is that the kind of life that one would have in an economy which didn't have inflation in it and sought to avoid inflation by using monetary policy would not be nirvana. That's for sure. It would not be anything like as pleasant as the life which I think most of us thought we were being promised by the economists and the politicians in the 50s and 60s. No question about it. But I think it would be a lot nicer than the life which we appear to be facing just at this moment. And that really is what I meant when I said I thought, first of all, we must define feasible goals and not utopian ones. But now this brings me on to the last part of what I want to say to you in terms of formal presentation. We said wage and price controls won't work. We've said that somehow if we started out without any inflation and ran a sensible monetary policy and faced the consequences of doing that for fiscal policy and for exchange rate policy, that we could probably keep inflation at bay and wouldn't have a bad state of affairs. But of course, we're not starting from a situation in which the inflation rate is zero and doing the right thing. We are starting from a situation in which the rate of inflation is 10%. and in which there is an unemployment problem. So I think the next question that anyone putting the kind of policy proposals that I'm discussing tonight must face is, how can you get there from here? How can you get to a state of price stability given that you are starting from a situation of double-digit inflation or thereabouts? And I guess you can sum up the answer to that question in one word, that one word being slowly. I think that there can be no question that if we were to go in a 12-month period from a monetary policy such as we've been having in this country over the last few years, which involves rates of monetary expansion of 15 to 17 to 18 and back to 15%, and we were suddenly to drop that rate of monetary expansion to zero and keep it there, that you would have a depression that would, well, I won't say would make the 30s look mild, but would be in the same league as the 30s. And if you want to see a little bit of evidence on that from the post-war world, please note that the rate of monetary expansion in the United Kingdom now has its highest unemployment rate in post-war history and its most rapidly rising unemployment rate in post-war history. You've got an excellent example now in Britain of what would happen if you tried to use monetary policy as a quick cure for inflation. I don't know whether the authorities in Britain knew what they were doing when they carried out that particular act of monetary contraction, but we can learn from their example, I think, not to do it here. Now again, there is some perfectly straightforward economics underlying this. Why is it that if you suddenly cut down the rate of monetary expansion, that the effect of that is not to bring the inflation rate down, but to create unemployment? And the answer to that is perfectly straightforward. And inflation, once it gets going, builds up a momentum of its own. It carries with it a lot of inertia. And that inertia comes from two sources. The first source is long-term contracts. When a wage agreement is signed, it's not for a week renegotiable or a month renegotiable. It's for 1 year or 2 years or 3 years. And once an employer has entered into an agreement with his labor force to pay them a certain rate of increase of wages over the next 2 or 3 years, he's stuck with that agreement. If suddenly you alter the rate of monetary expansion so that he can no longer maintain the scale of his operation in real terms, given that rate of increase of money wages that he's already contracted for, there's no way he can turn around and impose wage cuts. He's got to live with the time path of wages that he's agreed for, and his only alternative, if he's going to stay in business, is contract his output and contract his employment. So that's the first source of inertia in the system, long-term contracts. The second goes along with that, expectations. If you're bargaining for wages in Canada now over a 2 or a 3 year time horizon, both sides of that bargain, both employers and employees, must take a view as to what's going to happen to prices over the next 2 or 3 years before they can possibly have any sensible idea of what it means in terms of real outlay for the employer and real living standards for the employees to strike a particular bargain. In large measure, though not in total, and there's a great deal of evidence about this, inflationary expectations as to the future get extrapolated from the past behavior of the price level. So that once you've had an inflation going for a while, people come to expect it to continue. and strike their bargains as if they did expect it to continue. So that inflationary expectations, extrapolated from the past, get built into a bargain now, which rules for the next 3 years. And suddenly, you cut down the rate of monetary expansion on that, and you no longer have the rate of monetary expansion that would validate those expectations. The only thing that can come out of that is a contraction of real income and employment. There's no two ways about it. Now, to be sure, it's going to be a temporary contraction. And let me put large quotation marks around the temporary contraction. Why? Because nobody likes to be unemployed. And as contracts come up for renewal, you will find employers beginning to revise down their views of what they can get away with in the way of wage offers, and employees revising down their expectations of what they can get. And as that happens, those new wage bargains feed into a new time path of prices, and the rate of price inflation slows down. And as the rate of price inflation slows down, expectations begin to be revised downwards. So the next round of bargaining goes on at a lower rate of inflation. And eventually, but eventually is a number of years, not a number of weeks, eventually the economy settles down again to a more or less stable level of activity at a new and lower rate of inflation. Now, again, the evidence is that the more slowly you bring about this contraction, the less is the unemployment that you need to endure in the interim. You can either get rid of the inflation with a big bang, which might produce the revolution, or with a very slow squeeze, which certainly isn't going to be pleasant. Now let me come back to controls, because there is one, I think, marginally intellectually respectable argument for controls. And the marginally intellectually respectable argument for controls is as follows, that they affect expectations, and that they affect expectations independently of the past behavior of the inflation rate. And in doing so, give you a downward revision of those inflationary expectations that are going into contracts that are independent of the built-in momentum of the inflation rate, and somehow enable you to bring the inflation rate down faster at less cost in unemployment. Now, we have evidence about the effects of wage and price controls on expectations. It appears to be the case that in the United States, at the end of 1971, for about 3 months after the announcement of a complete freeze, inflationary expectations dropped. And at the end of the 3 months, they were back up to where they'd been in the first place. So for about 3 months, there is evidence that in the United States economy, that short, sharp shock effect worked. It had no influence on the long run of rate of inflation, but for just that little while, it did cause a blip in inflationary expectations. For the United Kingdom, we've also got evidence, and the evidence there appears to be that perhaps you fooled some of the people early on, but Britain has had so many batteries of one kind of control or the other that have been manifestly seen to fail that the introduction of wage and price controls in Britain in recent years has certainly had no effect on inflationary expectations whatsoever. So you can take it that there is something to this argument in the US context, nothing to it in the British context, and I don't know in the Canadian context. But ask the question, is there anything unique about the introduction of wage and price controls as far as getting this extra outside influence on expectations is concerned? And the answer to that surely must be no. What is important in influencing inflationary expectations downwards is that the authorities announce a policy which people expect to work and then are seen to be implementing that policy. If people believe that the government was serious about contracting its deficit, about cutting down the rate of monetary expansion, And if the government was seen to be doing that, then there is just as strong or as weak, but just the same case to be made that the implementation of monetary policy would have an extra influence on inflationary expectations, thereby making the transition to a low inflation rate easy as the introduction of wage and price controls. And I don't know how much weight to put on this argument. So that I come back to the proposition that if you are going to implement this policy, and please, I'm not putting it to you as one of a set of alternatives, I really am seriously putting it to you as the only policy that in the current state of knowledge we can have confidence in as working, that it had better be implemented slowly, because it is not going to be pleasant. Once you have inflationary expectations as deeply embedded into an economy as they are into this one, and as they are into the United Kingdom economy, they probably are not going to go away easily. And I don't know if you want to guess as to the number of years, shall we say 5, as the kind of time horizon over which such a policy might be viable. And I must say, there is one contrast between Britain and Canada, and that is that the governor of the Bank of Canada, unlike the governor of the Bank of England a few years ago, does seem to understand that. But now let me just come to the last point. I have heard it argued, and perhaps we'll hear it argued in the question period, that such a policy is all very well and probably would work, but a 5-year time horizon is simply not politically realistic. And therefore, as a very much second best solution, we must try this alternative. Now, consider an economy with an inflation rate round about 10%, and that inflation rate coming down a little bit. And consider that economy heading, or indeed having, its most serious unemployment problem in the post-war period. And consider that economy, or the people running that economy, being faced with the kind of advice that I am implicitly giving now. It's very understandable that the answer would be, that is not politically realistic. We cannot wait for 5 years to have this kind of policy work itself out. The voters will not stand it. We must have an alternative. Well, I could be talking about Canada in 1976, but I'm not. I am talking about Britain in 1971-72. When the inflation rate had just been over 10% and was just beginning to come down, the unemployment rate was rising up towards about 4.5% of the labor force, which was far higher than it had been in the post-war period before. And there's nothing that I'm saying to you tonight that I wasn't saying in Britain in 1971-72. And I was told that it was not politically realistic to think about a 5-year time horizon. Well, that 5-year time horizon has passed in the United Kingdom, and the unemployment rate is now 6.5%, and the inflation rate is 27%. And instead of the problem being over and done with, the problem has yet to be got to grips with. Now, I think the real message for the current Canadian problem in the British experience is not to make that mistake that the British economy made in 1971-72, to give up the monetary restraint, to give up the fiscal restraint, and rely upon wage and price controls. Because at the end of that politically impossible 5-year time horizon, Canada will be in an infinitely worse mess if it doesn't start get to grips with the problem now. Mr. Chairman, I will finish, I think, on that note.
Oh, there's only one of them, is there?
Yes, thank you very much. I don't know an occasion when there have been so many questions which have occurred to me, but I think it wouldn't be decent for me not to give you a chance first. So, Dr. Leitner has agreed.
Well, I think a question about a guaranteed annual income is a very sensible question, because poverty is a serious social problem. And I am perfectly happy to argue the case for a negative income tax which involves a guaranteed minimum annual income. But I think it would be a mistake to think that a policy like that, any more than monetary policy, is going to solve all the country's economic problems. That would be one way of getting to grips with the problem of poverty. That's one problem. Monetary policy is one way, or indeed the way, of getting to grips with the problem of inflation. So I don't think that the adoption of one kind of policy is going to solve all the problems.
Yes, Professor Warren.
Everybody consumes wealth or wishes to consume wealth, and very few people produce it. Are we not getting too large a percentage of our population, and I understand in Britain you have something less than 10% in primary production. In Canada we have around 9% in primary production. Isn't that placing too much of a burden on the few primary producers? And isn't that going to lead to inflation indirectly?
Repeat the question.
The question is it not the case that inflation is stemming from the fact that rather too small a proportion of the labor force is now actually engaged in primary production, and rather too large a proportion of the labor force is now engaged in service industries, indeed being university professors and such? I think the answer to that, I must say, is no. I think that the consequence of having rather a small proportion of the labor force devoted to primary production and rather a large proportion of the labor force devoted to other uses is to make the output of the primary sector expensive relative to the output of other sectors. But that really is a question of relative prices. That is not a question of the overall price level, which involves the price in terms of money, both of primary products, manufactured output, and services. And can I just come back to your premise? You said merely too much money chasing too few goods. Not merely. Yes, that's how it gets going. That's the story about the beginning of inflation. But then, and this really, I guess, is where large corporations, trade unions, and this probably do have a role to play in the inflationary process. Once the inflation gets going, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy, whereby you expect inflation, so you raise your price, and everybody's doing the same thing, so the price level goes up. And the only thing that's going to tell you to do something different is some contraction on the monetary side. Too little money chasing too many goods for a while.
Now, would you say that Canada planning to spend $42 billion next year instead of
You mean the federal government planning to do that? You know, I've been here 6 months. Shall I put it to you this way? In terms of inflation, over that kind of range, I don't think the level of government expenditure matters, so long as it isn't financed by printing money at the Bank of Canada. If you're going to have a 16% increase in the level of government expenditure, along with a 16% increase in federal taxes, then I have no particular reason to suppose that that's going to be inflationary. It might cause a lot of problems in other ways, but it's not necessarily a bad thing for inflation. Again, I don't think you realize how lucky you are here. You know, the British government is now spending, or the public sector, I had better say, over 60% of gross domestic product, and is borrowing 12% of gross domestic product every year. That's getting on for the entire savings of the private sector. And they're amazed that the private sector isn't accumulating capital.
Questions?
Okay. I think you downplay too much the one marginally acceptable argument for controls. You only talked about the possible influence on expectations. But what about an effect on the adjustment process itself? Whether or not it affects the expectations, does it change the time path towards the new equilibrium?
Let me hope that I've got it right, the question. Did I downplay what I called the marginally respectable argument for controls, in that if you can somehow coordinate the controls with the monetary policy, you can change the transition path towards a lower rate of inflation in favor of a higher level of employment while you're doing it? Well, I didn't mean to, because I really meant to state the case that way. But there really is a very serious problem here that comes from the timing of these effects. One of nature's natural constants seems to be that if you change the rate of monetary expansion this year, you'll change the inflation rate 2 years later. And that was something that was first noticed, I am told, by William Stanley Jevons in the 19th century. It's still true of the UK, it's been true of the United States. From looking some casual observation of Canadian statistics, it seems to be more or less true here. What this really means is that if you want to coordinate controls with monetary policy, you've got to get the monetary policy going now and start introducing the controls over the next 2 years just at the right time in order to coordinate with the monetary policy. It's a nice trick, but I don't really set too much store by it. But please notice that that's a very different argument from the government had to do something this year, so they introduced controls. It's an argument that says, the government started to control inflation last year, and now, as part of that carefully designed strategy set in motion last year, this year they're beginning to set controls in place. The reason I don't want to set too much store by this argument is the British evidence. I mean, as you know, my Ron Shearer mentioned my colleague Michael Parkin. Some of the work that he did on our program in Manchester involved looking at survey data of the British public's expectations about the inflation rate and trying to see what factors influenced that. Did elections influence it? Did the political color of the government influence it? Did the devaluation influence it in 1967? Did the introduction of controls in 1966 influence it? Did the introduction of controls in 1972 influence it? The answer to all of those questions except devaluation was no. But the devaluation produced a marked step up in the British population's expectations of inflation. So that suggests to me that those data are telling us something. And one of the things they're telling us is that by the mid-1960s, the average member of the British public was far smarter than the average British politician and bureaucrat and knew that the controls weren't going to work.
Professor Lehler. It seems to me that the federal government, if they were going to make a decision in regard to some medical problem, hospital arrangements or something, they would take the advice of the medical profession. I think if they were going to do something in the scientific field, a large expenditure like Triumph, they take the advice of the scientific community. Why is it that the economists can't, why are the economists not consulted by the government in these matters? Oh. Is it because the economists are divided and don't agree? Are the economists, say, 90% in favor of the point of view you presented here tonight? Or can they hire reputable economists from smaller universities that give them bad advice?
I mean, you have put your finger on the problem. The government have been taking the advice of economists. And as a result of taking the advice of economists, have got themselves into this muddle. I think that the post-war inflation, which has been slowly accelerating, you know, since about 1960 onwards, if you go back now and look at the data, can largely be attributed to this sort of newfound power of economists. They suddenly found themselves in positions of influence. They started giving advice, well-meant advice, based upon economic theories, which frankly have not held up in the face of the evidence. Now, it's one thing for a natural scientist in a laboratory to carry out an experiment and find out that it's wrong. I'm afraid my profession has been carrying out an experiment, and they found out that it is wrong. Now, well, I suppose that answers the question. No, I am in a very small minority in the profession. In terms of the economic doctrine that I'm putting forward, it's a very old economic doctrine. I'm told that Cicero propounded it. I know that Jean Bodin propounded it. I know that there is nothing that I've said tonight that David Hume would have found peculiar, or David Ricardo. But in the 1930s, there was a Great Depression. And because, I think largely, because people did not have access to proper data, that depression was attributed to non-monetary factors, when at least there is now a strong case, now that we have the data together, that we can, there's a strong case to be made for a contrary proposition. But no matter what happened in the 30s, the consequence for the economics profession was, first of all, John Maynard Keynes' general theory of income, employment, and whatever it is, prices, is that right? Dear me, thank heavens, yes. Which is a great book. But the consequence of that great book was that an extremely debased version of the theory in that book became adopted as the gospel for economic policymaking. Except in the United States. The United States clung to the old orthodoxy of monetary respectability, sound money, and balanced budgets. And the rest of the world was linked to the United States with fixed exchange rates. And that old fuddy-duddy, good King Eisenhower, went along with these antiquated views, much to the horror of the intellectual community. But I believe that the stability of the United States in the 50s, given the size of that economy, gave a built-in stability to the rest of the world that enabled them to carry out Keynesian policies without getting into severe inflationary problems. But there was a change of administration in the 60s, and there was a Vietnam War. And that Vietnam War was financed, like all wars have always been financed, by printing money. And because the rest of the world was linked to the United States by fixed exchange rates, that money that was printed in the United States spilled over the United States balance of payments into every other country and got the inflation going in every other country. The background of stability from a non-Keynesian economy that was required for the other Keynesian economies to get away with it, the rug was pulled away. My colleague Michael Parkin put it this way: they were always skating on thin ice and they forgot to change into their water wings when the ice melted. Well, I know this sounds like a lot of past history because we're talking about Vietnam, but I think what we're living with is the long drawn out cycle of trying to get to grips with that Vietnam War inflation. Now the international monetary system has broken down. Each economy is more or less on its own and is trying to deal with the inflation that first got into that country through the fixed exchange rates in its own way. And I think it's interesting that the countries that haven't resorted to wage and price controls, but have resorted to tight monetary policies, have got the lowest inflation rates. Now look at Germany. Look at Switzerland. And then compare them with the United Kingdom. And they were more or less to within a couple of percentage points in the same place as far as the inflation rate was concerned in the mid-60s.
Other questions?
Yeah, I think my comment is that I don't find that distinction too helpful, given the kind of propositions I've been putting to you. Because notice what I've been saying. I've been saying that inflation gets going because the money pulls it along. Demand pull inflation, if you like. But that once it gets going, the expectations and the long-term contracts get built in and keep it going. Cost push, if you like. Okay, so if you want to use that kind of category, that kind of dichotomy, I am talking about a model of the inflationary process which says demand pull gets it going, cost push validated by further demand pull keeps it going, and the only thing that's going to get rid of it is a reversal of the demand pull. But I just don't think it's helpful to think of inflation as a demand pull cause over there, a cost push cause over there. It's the interaction of the two sides of the market that you've got to understand.
Does that mean, in effect, then, that if you were to assume the world of a zero rate of inflation, that inflation can only be started by some sort of policy of the government?
The thing that makes me just stop a moment is the word started. No, look. An increase in the fourfold increase in the price of oil is going to give any price index a kick up. If the government then reacts to that by loosening up its monetary policy, then the inflation will get going. It might incidentally be wise to do it in those circumstances. I don't want to say that inflation is so absolutely evil that at all costs we've always got to get rid of inflation and nothing else. But it's a problem, and other things being equal, I would like to be rid of it. Okay, but let me come back. Never has there been a sustained inflation without that monetary expansion. Never has there been a monetary expansion without a sustained inflation. But there are lots of little things that can give a kick that somehow set going the political process from which that monetary expansion gets generated. Does that help? Yeah, okay. Yeah, yes, the question is, suppose everybody expected the inflation to be going on, would it then be a serious problem? I mean, what about certain Latin American economies? That is an intellectually respectable argument. I must recognize it as such. It's not one that I really hold to, but I'm not quite sure why I don't hold to it. I think the reason is that the idea of an inflation that is fully adjusted to is so remote from any empirical reality that we can dismiss it as that as being a relevant model. Let me make the following distinction to you. Let's use the words expected and anticipated to mean the things they really mean. Expected means you've taken a view to the future. You know it's going to happen. Anticipated means you've looked at your expectation and you've acted on it. Right? There's a sense of action in anticipation. Now, we've got an inflation rate of 10% now. Suppose everybody in this room and everybody in the whole economy expected the rate of inflation to be 10% next year and the year after. So it was fully expected. That wouldn't make a bit of difference if 5 years ago you signed a pension contract in the expectation that the inflation rate would be zero. You're tied into that, and you haven't anticipated the inflation, you see. Contracts being all indexed have got to be indexed when you start. There's an awful muddle in going back to index ex post insurance contracts and pension contracts that were entered into previously. But if you want to raise the question of indexation, let's go into it. If an economy had a zero inflation rate and all its contracts were indexed, then the transition to a positive inflation rate would be relatively easy. The transition back to a zero inflation rate would be very easy. All right? In that sense, that kind of inflation wouldn't be much of a problem. It also, incidentally, wouldn't do the government any good, because it wouldn't get that kind of extra revenue out of it that it gets from debasing the public debt that it's already issued, and so on. Okay? So if we had indexation all along, who cares? But now we're talking about introducing indexation into an economy that's already got inflation into it. And that is a different matter. It's a different matter for two reasons. First, capital markets are in a mess during inflation. And we know that in real terms, a lot of interest rates are negative. Right? You know, the nominal rate of interest minus the rate of inflation is a negative number. You are actually paying people for the privilege of lending to them. Imagine what you would do to capital markets by introducing an index security into that. You'd grind everything to a halt. It's like sitting on the rate of monetary expansion, jacking up real interest rates with a big step immediately. So that's the first reason why I'm not too happy about capital market indexing. Okay? Secondly, you know, what is indexing? What are you doing? You've had money, it's been stable, you've decided to use that money as the unit of account for transactions and credit contracts and such. The government now comes along and essentially debases that unit of account and makes a good thing out of it. Do you really think then that if you started tying contracts to some price index that the government wouldn't start debasing the price index? Of course it would. It would start cooking the books immediately. Let's go back to the UK experience. We had indexed wage agreements called threshold agreements in 1973. The rules, or was it 74, I beg your pardon. The rules of the game were that for every percentage point increase in the cost of living index above 7% before October 1974, an extra pound a week. The government actually introduced a budget which reduced indirect taxes and did other various things with, I believe, the sole purpose of causing a downward hiccup in the retail price index for a couple of months, because that's all they could have hoped to achieve, which defrauded me and everybody else that had an indexed contract of £2 a week. Okay? Moreover, in the construction of the price index in Britain, certain things are a matter of discretion. Which seasonal fruits and vegetables go in? Those decisions are normally taken by civil servants. But while threshold agreements were coming into force, which seasonal fruit and vegetable that went into the price index, anecdotal evidence has it, became a matter for the cabinet. Now, Britain is supposed to be a mature democracy. And if a mature democracy starts cooking the books so quickly, I think that you can't expect too much in the way of protection from indexation. But now let me come to the last point about indexation. Long-term contracts and expectations. If you start building cost of living escalator clauses into long-term contracts, you make them that much more flexible. And I think there is something to be had in terms of easing the transition to lower rates of inflation from having flexible cost of living escalator clauses in wage contracts. I wouldn't impose them, because I don't think that a government would know how to write the legislation for all the different institutional details in different industries any more than it knows how to write the regulations for wage and price controls in all those industries. I would just encourage it in the private sector.
Well, we could go on for a long time, because there are many more questions left, but I think that it is time to terminate the question period. And I want to, first of all... Sure. Can you speak louder, please?
No. Okay. It would make it easier to borrow money.
Thanks. Okay. I want to make an announcement, first of all, about next week's talk. We're going to have Dr. Gerard Peel here, who has an honorary degree from UBC, and he's also been the longtime publisher of that great publishing miracle, The Scientific American, and he's going to be talking about that here next week at the same time. In deciding who should thank the speaker tonight, I thought we could either choose one of the judges or one of the economists in the audience, because the controls are going to give lots of work for both of them. But I finally thought it would be better to ask one of the economists, and Tony Scott from UBC has agreed to thank the speaker on your behalf.
Thank you.
fiscal policy